welcome back. I hope everyone had a wonderful Pesach. For those who were here, I hope you enjoyed the snow. For those who were not here, boy, you missed it. One of the most famous rabbis of the 18th century was Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who was the rabbi in Posen, in Poland. And his son, I think it was his son, Rabbi Leibula Eiger, wrote that if you have snow on the night of the Seder, it's a good sign. Because we have a verse, Imchatayichem kashanim kashela yalbinu. If your sins are as red as scarlet wool, they will become white like snow. So he said, if you have snow on the night of the Seder, which I imagine happened from time to time in Poland, then you can be assured that God has desired your Seder and has forgiven your sins. You should get something out of snow on the Seder, right?
Yes, we were down south. We not only had snow on second Seder, we had a power outage.
Oh, yes, right. I heard about this. We had Choshech also. They had Barad and Choshech. Well, a Jew is obligated to see himself as though he had left Egypt, so Yotzezai, you fulfilled your obligation.
We did.
Okay. Well, we now go from snow and power outages to the flood. And we are back in Noach. And by the way, just something to think about. I had emailed Rebecca that I'm thinking about what to do next year and what we might do. We could, you know, the range of possibilities is open. As long as it's text study, we could pretty much decide whatever we want to do. So we could continue to do Midrash. Whether of Noah or whether some other section is certainly an option. And I like doing Medrash because, aside from the methods, which are interesting, you sort of have a different topic every week, but you're still within a broader theme. So, you know, I think that's an enjoyable thing to do. On the other hand, we could go back to doing Navi. We could pick another book out of Tanakh to do. There are still a few left we haven't done. So that's an option. Or we could look at something else entirely. I'm open to suggestions. Please email me. I don't want to turn it into a discussion here right now because we have matters to do.
Is the boat going to land by the time we're finished this
year? The boat might not even get going. We haven't seen a drop of rain yet. Wait and see. So this medrash that we are about to tackle is, we're now reaching the end of the third sequence of midrashim, meaning the first sequence of midrashim that we saw described Noach himself and what makes Noach special and Noach's righteousness and the question of Noach versus his generation, comparing Noach to Moshe, Noach to Abraham, and so on. That was the first sequence of midrashim that we saw at the start of the year. We then moved into a second sequence of midrashim, which talked about why God is destroying the earth. What is their sin? And we define Hamas and talked about the idea that the land is filled with Hamas, and that, you know, took us through a second sequence. We're now getting towards the end of our third sequence of Midrashim, and this is the series that deals with construction of the boat, the materials, the dimensions, the values involved in its design. So we began by learning that the boat is a mitzvah for Noah. It's a mitzvah action in which the details assigned by God are part of the mitzvah. The same way that every mitzvah has certain mitzvah components, activities you have to perform in order to say, okay, I fulfilled this. There are, for Noah, all sorts of rules that he has to fulfill. So he has to build it out of this material and with these dimensions and so on. Then we looked at the idea of residences on the boat and the Torah's use of the word kinim to describe the residences, which is a word associated with purification, and we talked about that. And then we went on to the boat being aligned with Kofar as opposed to Moshe's boat, which is lined with Chemar and Zephet. And we talked about survival versus comfort and how you value each. And then we picked up on the Vav in Vizet, and this is the way you shall build it, which connected Noach's boat with the Beis HaMikdash, the temple built in Jerusalem. All of this should sound very familiar. You should be very bored with this list. Then we talked about why the Torah gives us the dimensions of Noach's boat and suggested that it was meant as an engineering lesson. whether that's the state of the art or not. We then moved into the question of the illumination of the boat and what this was. Was it a gem? Was it a window? This sohar that's used in order to provide light inside the boat. And now, today, I expect to actually see two midrashim because they're both brief. And their points are basically technical. These are, as we'll see, of the variety of midrash that doesn't really look to provide an ethical lesson as much as it's simply explaining text. It's the rabbis looking at a text and saying, this requires some kind of exploration because the literal text is missing something. We need to add something here. That's really what we're going to see. I don't see this as something that's going to provide deeper guidance, but please, if you come up with something, I'd love to hear it. They both look at what I brought you here, source number one. Source number one is the verse which we've already looked at in terms of the Tzohar, part of God's instructions to Noah to build the boat. Tzohar ta'aseh la'teva, you shall make a tzohar for the boat. I choose not to translate the word tzohar because now we know that it could be a window and it could be a gem. So you shall make a tzohar for the boat. Ve'el ama techalena milamala. And to an ama we've seen before is a cubit, right? Somewhere about 21.6 inches, we said. To an ama you shall make the boat terminate above. That's actually the first phrase we're going to look at today, trying to understand what that means. And then it says, you shall place the entrance of the boat in its side. Okay, the boat's entrance is in the side of the boat. Lower, second, and third levels, you shall make it. We're not going to get to that today. That last clause, God willing, will be the last of the Midrashim in the series on the structure of the boat, and I hope to get to that next week. But first, we have to understand this phrase, to an ama you shall make the boat terminate above. What does that mean to you? Just reading the words, ignoring the pretty diagrams, which I worked hard on, so don't make fun of them. To an ama you shall make the boat terminate above. What does that sound like?
Come to a point.
Sorry,
it sounds like there's an
amma
above.
There's an amma above, or to a point. So Sharon says maybe it means that you have your living space or whatever it is, and then above that you have an amma. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, but I don't know how big it is. In other words, I don't know if it's amma by amma.
Right.
Or do you know what it means?
Yeah, amma is a single dimension for a three-dimensional object.
So I don't know if it's as long as the rack.
Good. So Ralph suggests that it's coming to a point, or not really a point, but to an amma. In other words, it's going to curve at the top. We've already seen this boat as a rectangle. But what we're suggesting is that the walls are going to arc with a C, and then they'll terminate at a point where it's an amma across, right? So that's certainly a way that you could look at this. And then the amma dimension is width. Essentially, that will be the assumption, is that it's curving to a point, and then the top beam going, you know, down the boat is going to be an amma wide, and is going to go the length of the boat. That, or however you work that. I mean, it does have to be a single beam, but the but that's a possibility. So our medrash is going to present us with two views as to what the dimensions are. I'm sorry, not dimensions, but how to understand this phrase. But in order to get there, it has this other discussion, which is a really complicated discussion, which I tried to the best of my ability to simplify, using the addition of the Eitz Yosef, who slightly alters the addition that existed before his. I'll point out his variation a little bit, but we're going to work with his addition of it. Take a look, please, at source number two. And we're going to illustrate the ideas with source number three. Ve'el ama techalena milamala. Okay, to an ama you shall finish it, or you shall make the boat terminate, as I translated it earlier, and that's really a better way to translate it. To an ama you shall make the boat terminate above. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemya. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemya debated the layout on the boat. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda said, Shlosh Meos Ushloshim Kilin Hayuba. He says there were 330 kilin in the boat. Now we saw the word kilin a few weeks back and said that was the rooms or the residences. We had it on the Medrash that talked about kinin being the boat. The word kilin, I'm not going to revisit everything from then now, just is rooms. So he says there were 330 rooms on the boat. Eser Amos al Eser Amos. Each one is 10 by 10 Amma. Okay, that's your space. Now, try to imagine the elephant in the 10 by 10 Amma space. Probably doesn't work too well, because if we've said an Amma is 21.6 inches, let's work with that as our number. So it's 216 inches. 216 inches, we'll call it roughly 18 feet, right? So it's 18 feet by 18 feet. Whether you are a sparrow or whether you are an elephant, that's your space. Or so it appears right now. But those are your dimensions. And two open spaces, he adds, ushte platiot. Platiot is a word that you find in Talmudic Greek / Aramaic. It means an open space. Shal arba amot, of four amma. And what we mean when we say four amma is really four by ten, as we'll see. Kilin mikan, vikilin mikan. Rooms on this side, rooms on that side. Vikilin mikan, and rooms on this side and on that side. Ubeis amos litzdadim, and then two amot on the sides. Was that in any way, shape, or form clear?
No.
So you should all be grateful for the fact that I have very poor spatial thinking. Like, I can't imagine things without actually seeing them. When I try to do that, it just gives me a headache. So therefore, I had to sweat over this one. And what I ended up doing was coming up with the drawings that you see here in source number 3, representing the views of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemya. And now let's go through it, and I'll show you the way the words work. But just to orient you in terms of what this is supposed to represent, imagine, please, that the front of the boat is down there at that wall. The back of the boat is behind me. So when we're told in the verse that it is shlosh meot arka, 300 amot long, that's 300 cubits this way. It's 50 cubits wide. So that's the dimension this way. And what I'm trying to show in my diagram in number 3 is a width cross-section. So in other words, when you see Rabbi Yehuda, and then it says 1, the 1 is down there, and then 10, 4, 10, 10, 4, 10, 1 is the way to look at it. And the idea is that each of these rows, right, if you imagine an airplane, it's like the rows on an airplane going across, that's what we're talking about, with slightly more space. The rows on the airplane, like each of these is one row, and then they go all the way back. Although, we won't get to the discussion where the lavatory is until next week. That's next week's Medrash. Yes. That wasn't a joke. That was serious. So
these are right from port to starboard.
Yes, that is correct. Since we are going to be naval, you know, you got to use the right terminology. Right, and that's fore and that's aft. Okay, but don't ask me where the stern and the lee are, because it depends on which way the wind is blowing.
Which is starboard and which is port?
Starboard is to the right and port is to the left.
Oh, I thought it was
front. No, that's port and stern. That's stern and sorry. Okay. In any case, somewhere there's a bow too, but I'm not sure where. Just don't drop anchor because you don't want to in a flood. Okay. In any case, imagining that now, going back to Rabbi Yehuda's wording, he says, overall on the boat, in all three decks of the boat combined, you have 330 rooms. How do you get that? He says the rooms are 10 by 10. Ushte platio chal arba amot. You know, I think I'm actually gonna go through this twice. First in his wording and then in the diagram. So you have two open spaces of four amot, and he uses those as aisles, Rabbi Yehuda. Each room has to have an entrance. But because he's putting these rows in sequence without a break between them, the entrance has to be on the side. Right? You can't enter from, imagine that this is one of the rooms. You can't enter this way because there's a row in front of you. You can't enter from where I am because there's a row behind you. So your entrances have to be on the side. So the way to do it is you have two aisles. That's where you have the number 4 in your diagram, because there are 4 amot across, about 7 feet. And the way it's going to work is kilin mikan v'kilin mikan. He says on each side you have each side of the aisle you have a room. So the gradient box that says 10 is a room. The white box that says 4 is an aisle. And then the kilin mikan v'kilin mikan on the other aisle also. Ubeis amos l'tzadim, and then 2 amot on the ends. And that's it. So in other words, if you want to leave the 2 side rooms, right, the room that's on the starboard side and the room that's on the port side, if you want to leave those rooms, you have 21.6 inches of clearance between you and the wall of the boat. That's it. So good luck putting the elephant in those rooms. But, you know, maybe the sparrows get those rooms. But that's the way that Rabbi Yehuda envisions this working. So working from the diagram alone, it means from one side of the boat you have a 1 amma aisle, then you have a 10 amma room, then a 4 amma aisle, then a 10 amma room, which abuts another 10 amma room, and you hope they don't mind the noise of the adjoining wall. Then you have a 4 amma aisle, another 10 amma room, and then 1 amma, and you're at the wall of the ship. Got it? That's Rabbi Yehuda's version of this. Then you get Rabbi Nechemya. Rabbi Nechemya Amar, Tes Meos Kilin Hayuba. Rabbi Nechemya said, we haven't explained how you get to 330 out of that. We still have to get there. Yeah.
Where did they get this?
So hang on. We're getting there. Rabbi Nechemya Amar, Rabbi Nechemya said, Tes Meos Kilin Hayuba. There were 900 rooms, he says. And how do you do that? Just ask the developers for Thornhill. They'll explain. It's really easy. Just make the rooms smaller. So, the keel vav amos al vav amos. Each room is going to be 6 amma by 6 amma, which now, working with the 21.6, right? So that means that you're talking about 126 inches by 126 inches, give or take. So in other words, your rooms are basically 10.5 feet by 10.5 feet. That's all you get in this prison cell. The gimel platios shall arba arba, but now he has to have 3 aisles because he's cramming in more rooms. So each aisle is still 4 amma by 4 amma. Vikil mikan, vikil mikan. Then you have the rooms on either side of each of these aisles. Ubeis amos l'tzadin, and 1 amma running down each side. Why you need the 1 amma on each side, we're not going to get to yet. That's coming. But what Rabbi Nechemya does, if you look at his diagram, now it becomes, I think, more clear, is he has 1 amma aisle on the side, right? Then you have a 6 amma room. Then you have a 4 amma hallway aisle. Then you have a 6 amma room. Then that's abutted by another 6. And then you have another hallway. Then another 2 rooms that are side by side. Then 4, then 6, then 1. I did my best to try to make this somewhat scaled. So, you know, it's not perfect because Microsoft Word isn't easy for this sort of thing. But I think you get the sense of what they're describing. Okay? Now, that does not explain how you're going to get to 330 or 900 rooms. So how does that work? And the answer is that you have 300 amos in length, right? So Rabbi Yehuda is going to say, these rows are crammed in, end to end. There is no pool on this cruise, okay? There's no bar. There's no, you don't have like a tennis ball court, none of that. This is it. This is your residence and nothing else. So, row after row after row, according to Rabbi Yehuda, each row is 10 amma deep, right? Therefore, you're going to have 30 of these per level, right? So if each row has 4 rooms, then how many do you have on a level? 120. So if you multiply that out by 3 levels, you have 360. And the traditional addition says 360. However, because of something that's coming in the second half of the Medrash, the Eitz Yosef says it's a mistake. It shouldn't say 360, it should say 330, and we'll see what that is in a few minutes. You should be so lucky. So that's what he has. Now, we still don't know where in the world he got the idea that each room is 10 by 10. Right? That seems to have been invented. So hang in there. We won't answer it, but we'll give you a better question. That's all Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Nechemia says each row is 6 amot deep. Right? Instead of being 10 amot, it is 6 cubits. So now, it's 300 for the floor. That means that you can fit in how many of these rows? 50 of them. Each row has how many rooms?
6.
6. You have 6 rooms. So that means how many per floor? 6 rooms per row. 50 rows? 300. 300. So therefore, if you do your math, you have all told 900. 900 rooms on this boat. Parenthetically, how many species of animals do you think he has to fit on this boat? I think we're talking double occupancy for these rooms. Okay. So that's the way we get that's the way we get this. Then our Medrash gets to the point of what this is about. Why are we introducing these maps? And the answer is, it isn't really about figuring out how many rooms are on the boat, but it's actually about that phrase, to an amma you shall make the boat terminate above. And the Medrash asks a question. We're now in the second part of this Medrash in source number 2. Al date to Rabbi Yehuda lo nicha, ve'al date to Rabbi Nechemia lo nicha. Within the view of Rabbi Yehuda, it doesn't work. Within the view of Rabbi Nechemia, it doesn't work. Meaning, the math doesn't work if I assume that your boat has to terminate at an amma on top, because it has to curve. And if it's curving, you're losing some of your space on the top level. So how do I make this work? Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda explained, Ka'amasa milamata, kach amasa milamala. Ve'elama techalena milamala. So as the Eitz Yosef understands it, Rabbi Yehuda says, like it's amma. Oh, you know what I did here? Hang on. I followed Eitz Yosef in one and not in the other. Let me make sure I have this clear before I confuse everybody. The way you have it in the English is fine. I just have to flip the way I have it in the Hebrew. So follow along with the way it is in the English, and you'll be fine. Before I upload the audio, I'll make sure to change the document here, so as to confuse the minimum number of people. But here's the situation. Following what you see in the English, I'm reading the second line, Rabbi Nechemia, not Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Nechemia says, like its amma measure below, so was its amma measure above. Meaning that the phrase to an amma means below and above, it's all the same dimension. The width does not change, it's a box. That's the way Rabbi Nechemia looks at the boat, is that it's actually a box. So it's rectangular in shape, and the sides do not incline. That's Rabbi Nechemia's understanding of the way this works. And therefore, he can fit 300 per floor. You follow? That's the way he understands the phrase, to an amma, you shall finish it above. Whereas, Rabbi Yehuda says, kimin komroton haisa. It was like a komroton. We're going to come back to that word soon. It was like a komroton. V'haya mashkif ba v'ola. It ascended, slanting and ascending. Umashkif ba v'ola. It's slanted and ascended. Ad shehe emida al amasa, until he reached an amma in width. Shenamar, quoting that same passage, ve'alamata chalena milamala, that you shall make the boat terminate to an amma. To an amma, you shall make the boat terminate above. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, it actually slants on the upper floor, and therefore he has to take out the side rooms, and therefore he's only going to have 330 rooms. If this sounds confusing now, believe me, it's not nearly as confusing as it was for me. But that's the basic idea, is that he has eliminated some rooms in order to make this work. Are we clear?
Yeah.
Okay. How many he had to eliminate and from which part is actually a really good question. But the way Rabbi Yehuda does it, as he understands it, the top floor is only 40 cubits wide. It's only 40 amma wide. And so because of that, you can only have three rows of rooms. And because you only have three rows of rooms, you can only fit 90, three rows meaning three columns, I suppose I should really call them, fore to aft, right? You only have three columns of rooms, so to speak. And the result is that, remember, he had 30 rows on it. 30 rows of three columns means that you have 90 on top. So I have 120 on the bottom floor, 120 on the middle floor, and then 90 on the top floor, and the result is going to be 330. Is everyone, are we clear on this? It is actually relatively straightforward. I'm just making it more confusing than it needs to be. Rabbi Yehuda simply says that on the top floor you can't have four rooms per row. There's no room because your boat is slanting. And therefore, on the top floor, you're only going to fit in three rows. You're only going to fit three rooms per row. That's the idea. That's probably the best way that I can say it. So that's the design of it. And what they're really debating has nothing to do with how many rooms there are on the boat. What they're really debating is simply the fate of the top floor. But along the way, we get this really interesting debate about how many rooms there are. 900 rooms versus 330 rooms, perhaps 360 rooms. So I want to come back to that in a moment. But first, I wanted to address this word komrotown. What in the world is a komrotown? So clearly this is not a Hebrew word. This is not even an Aramaic word. This word is Greek/Latin in origin. So what is it? So there is a part of the Mishnah which outlines laws of purity and impurity for various vessels, and it's called kalim. Kalim meaning implements. And at one point it describes what I brought you in source number 4. It describes a setup in which you have a box with a cushion underneath it. And with the box you have something called a kimron, which is spelled much like this komroton. It's kuf yud mem resh vav nun. And there they suggest that what it means is some kind of a lid or cover for a box. Based on that, some will explain that what Rabbi Yehuda means when he says that this boat is like a komroton is that it's like it has some kind of a domed lid on top of it. Kimur, bidyuk, same word. That's what they suggest, is that it's like a curved lid on top. But in terms of the etymology of the word, I think you have to go with what I wrote in the second line of source number 4, and that is the word camera in Latin. The word camera in Latin does not mean phone. The word camera in Latin means room, and in particular, a vaulted or domed chamber is one of the classic meanings for the word camera. So komroton simply means it's a vaulted chamber. That's the idea. Now, there is a problem with this. And if you flip the page, you see it in source number 5. I told you that next week we're going to get to the medrash that answers where the lavatory is, but the truth is we're going to see into it right now. Take a look at source number 5. The medrash next week is going to talk about the three levels of the boat and what you're supposed to use each level for. And as you see here in the Eitz Yosef commentary in source number 5, he says, Kasha, this is difficult. Lemanda amar tachtiyim lizvalim. According to the one who says that the bottom level is meant for trash, for refuse, and I use that word politely, they weren't throwing out plastic wrappers. Lamali kinim umid, 5 cents. Lamali kinim umidorim lamata. So why did they have levels on the rooms on the bottom level? If that's where you put your trash, no one's living there. How could you tell me you have 900 rooms and 300 of them are in landfill? So his answer is Vishema Yesh Lamar, perhaps you could say Dilav Davka Kinim Umidorim Mamash Kaamar Bichulhu. It didn't mean literally that there were rooms throughout, 900 rooms on the boat or 330 rooms on the boat. Ella, rather, Hachiki Amar, this is what it's saying. Shahaya Shi'ur Maspik La'asos Mehem Kidim U'Medorim B'Shi'ur Anizkar. It's saying that if you work with the dimensions that we're giving you, there is enough space for this number of rooms. Hypothetically, there would be 900 rooms worth, even though in part of it we just mean that it's space equivalent to, not that there are actual rooms there. That's his way to solve the problem. Frankly, a second way to solve the problem is simply to say that these are conflicting midrashim. We've seen that before, right? For example, in the discussion about Noach and his righteousness, we had different views. We had different explanations for what the word Hamas means. So it could be that these are simply competing views of the way that the space on the boat was used. It doesn't have to be, you know, we don't have to resolve the two midrashim with each other, except that if the space there is not used for trash, then the question is, so where did the trash go?
In the water.
You can't necessarily open the door. Yeah. It's not always safe. There's a door in the side of the boat, but that door stays closed much of the time. Sorry?
Why?
How would we know what?
That door stays closed. Why wouldn't it be possible to make a window and dump a pail out?
Well, I'm thinking during 40 days of rain, right? It's a dangerous thing to open the window. It's not a glass pane.
It's miserable out there right now, but we could open a window
and
dump
outside,
right?
This is hardly rain.
It depends, I suppose, on how we look at what was going on out there. But we've talked about boiling water that they're drifting in. Not that the rain is boiling, but that scientifically, with this volume of water, it will heat up, and the Medrash says that we're dealing with boiling water, although it also suggests the water around the boat cools off, so I don't know.
It's a hurricane.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want that job.
Doesn't it say after the water subsides that Noah has to wait until God opens the door for him, I think?
Well, that's as far as departure, right? God tells him it's time to go.
But that suggests that opening the door is not something that Noah...
Maybe, but even still, he has the window. Meaning that's the door, that's the entrance. Right, because before that, before he ever gets the instruction to open the door, he's sending out birds from the chalon. So he has a window that he is able to open and close at some point. Whether he's doing it during the 40 days or not, I don't know. But the rest of the time, he is able to open a window, which is good for ventilation. So...
But aside from the technical aspect of it, there's a lot of refuse.
Yes. Yes. Well, one assumes so, unless you're going to suggest that they have the goats. You know? But even still, there's refuse. Yes, I don't know. Yes. Okay. So, what is the point of the number of rooms? What is the point of telling me there are 330 rooms, there are 900 rooms, right? We understand now that what we're facing here is fundamentally just a discussion about how to translate a set of words. Right, the words to an amba you shall complete the boat. But what's with the number of rooms? We don't need the math on the rooms. Meaning, this could have just been a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehemiah about how to understand those words. In other words, whichever edition I'm going to work with, but one rabbi says that the boat is straight up and down, and the other rabbi says the boat curves like a komrotone. And that would have been it. It would have been a much shorter medrash. I wouldn't have needed to make all these diagrams. Why are we playing games with math? Yeah?
Possibly by taking the number of rooms, we're going to figure out the number of animals, there we're going to get number of people and sort of get an idea of who actually occupied.
Right. So, excellent. That was actually my first approach to this, was you're trying to address the question of how the boat fit all the animals and who is where and what and yes, sorry for the unicorn. The problem that I have with this answer, although I think it's the most practical answer, is that the Medrash doesn't say so. Meaning, if they're addressing a question, they normally give us some inkling of the question they're asking. You know, if they're asking the question of how did the boat fit everybody, then number one, we're missing the question. And number two, perhaps more important, they're missing information, because I don't know if it's one animal per room. I don't know if it's one species per room. I don't know how this works. Where are the butterflies? Are all the butterflies crammed into one of these 10 by 10 amla spaces? obviously the whole question in general of what in the world we're talking about, a boat that has all these species, is always lurking in the background. But even within what this Medrash seems to be doing, which is taking the description of the boat very literally, we're missing information. If you're trying to explain where everybody was, I'm missing a whole lot of information. So what else could this be? I hope so. When the world was young. The answer is I don't know. I mean, you could hypothesize that he brings young on the boat. In other words, he's not bringing full-grown animals. He's bringing the baby elephant, which works for the first few months.
These would only be the animals known to whoever composed this book.
But from my belief and the belief of the rabbis in this Medrash, that's God. And therefore, the animals known to him are whatever animals other than the sea creatures are going to need to survive on this boat. So that's the question. The question is not, you know, what is a critical read of the text going to produce? The question is, I am working with the Medrash. I need to know how the Medrash looks at it.
I
want to
say something, and I don't even know how to say it.
Okay.
So, I'm being influenced here by another story where there isn't enough room for somebody.
Yeah.
So, are we looking here at the ability to save all creatures? Is there something about the rooms and the stories of the people because there's a compassionate element to this, or... I'm not quite sure what I want to say, but...
It's significance, not reality.
I don't know. It's an interesting idea. I'd like to hear you develop it more. Because I'm not entirely sure that I'm getting it. I'm going to come back to that one. I think that's a very important thing.
In Christianity, the story is that there was no room at the inn.
Right.
So here that it's all-encompassing, that there is room for the saving...
Only of animals, not
animals.
Well, yes, right. Because the men have demonstrated their character.
But there's something about a compassionate God. I'm not quite sure.
But why didn't he make it 400 amma long then, and then we could have fit in more groups?
I'm
wrestling with this. On one level, I think the answer really may be that this veers into what's called remez. In the very beginning of the year, we talked about Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, the four classic levels of biblical interpretation. And we said there's a level called Remez, in which numbers have significance, in which initials have significance. Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. If you go to yutara.org and you look for Living Midrash, you'll find that class recorded there. And you can hear the discussion that we had then. But Remez, within the world of Remez, of hints, is what Remez literally means, numbers have special significance. If you ever heard the word gematria, right, from the Greek, the geometry, words, letters in Hebrew are assigned meaning. You'll say, the name Moshe, has a numerical value of 345 because each letter has a numerical value and therefore a total is 345, and that's meant to signify fill in the blank, and then we go on from there. Yeah.
I was just thinking the only way this could work with all the animals and everything is somehow we were all drugged. The lion and the bird were all together in no rooms. They were all together.
Laid out there on the floor.
I understand the difficulty.
But one approach is to say that what they're trying to accomplish here is not to tell me how many rooms there are on the boat, but rather the 10 by 10, 6 by 6, and all of these numbers have significance. And in fact, there is a commentary to Medrash called the Commentary of the Mahari, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac of Zidichov. And he provides Kabbalistic explanations for all of these numbers, which I started to work on for this and said, no, I'm sorry. Because it's just really, like, you have to really know serious mysticism in order for it to make any sense. And it's hard to work with. But he comes up with a whole explanation of what they're trying to get across and what the debate is between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah. And what he suggests, effectively, that this Medrash is not really Medrash alone. Medrash, remember, we explained, is the rabbi is paying attention to anomalies in the language of the Torah, as opposed to Pshat, which is anomalies in the story. Medrash is anomaly in the language and trying to explain it, but trying to explain it on a very rational, simple level. Remez goes beyond that and says God, there's a whole other level that God is intending for the reader, and you have to be a student of that in order to grasp it. So that's another take to this. But what I actually favor at this point goes back to what Ralph was saying before. I think what this is really about is the sage is trying to understand a simple understanding of biblical text. They're sitting here and reading this and saying, what's going on in this story? What happened here? God told Noah to build a boat. We have certain dimensions, but some information is missing. We know the dimensions of the boat as a whole, but we don't know how big the rooms are. We don't know what the layout of the rooms is. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda and Nechemiah get to talking, and they say, well, if you did it this way, you could fit in 330 rooms. If you did it this way, you could fit 900 rooms. What hints do we have in the text? Well, there's this thing about it culminating at an amma, and maybe that means that it's to an amma, meaning that the dimension is standard the whole way up, or maybe it means it's coming to a point on top, and so we have that midrashic debate. But fundamentally, what I think we are learning here, and it's a very valuable lesson, is a way to approach stories within the Torah where we are not given enough explanation. Because the same thing could be said for pretty much every story in the Torah. No, think about it. Even the stories that we have so much material on. Three beings come to Abraham at his tent, right? And start talking to him and to his wife, and they say, oh yeah, you're going to have a child, and one of them two of them go off to destroy the city of Sodom. Like, there's a whole lot of information we're missing in that story, even though we know what the menu was at the meal. There's still a whole lot of information that we're not told. The Torah isn't giving us everything, and what we're learning here is that it is not only acceptable, but it's even recommended, because they're putting it in the Medrash, to explore questions like that. And to imagine for ourselves, what is going on in this story? I think that's a very valuable point, that we are meant to do this. We're meant to explore this kind of detail and fill in the gaps to the best that we can. Not in a way that's going to contradict the text, and that's important, because sometimes people explore a story and come up with all sorts of creative reads that just contradict everything about the story within the text. That's not what I'm looking for. But what I think we're seeing here is explore and fill in the gaps to the extent that you can. That's what I'm seeing here. Okay. We still have a second medrash to see, which I wanted to make sure I would fit in today. So let's take a look at it. It's on the next clause back in source number one. I wanted to fit it in because it's really not big enough to occupy its own, and it's of the same bent, trying to figure things out, and also, well, you'll see it. I don't need to tell you about it. We're going to see it. But the clause in the original sentence in source number one, Ufesa hateva betzida tasim, you shall place the entrance of the boat in its side. Okay? Yeah, I don't know. Left side, right side? It depends on which way you're standing.
Okay, so the front is flat, the back is flat, two sides are flat. That's four sides.
Right. Well, when we use the word sad in general, which is the Hebrew, I think we mean, and maybe this is just a bias of mine, but I think that we know it doesn't include the top and the bottom. We have words, lamala, lamata, that we use for top and bottom. So I think you could say for sure that it's one of these four sides. If I'm going to take the view that the top curves, right, that I would be more inclined to place it in the fore or the aft, because this is curving, right, logically. And I want it on the top floor based on what we're going to see in next week's Medrash about who's living where. It makes sense for it to be on the top floor. So if that's true, then I've established that it's either on the front or the back. Keep in mind, there is no front and back, because it's a rectangle. But it's not moving in any particular direction. So it's on the front or the back would be my guess, the fore or the aft, to satisfy Shana. But that's really the best I could do with it. So where did the movie put it?
On this side.
On that side. They put it on the starboard side. Okay. Well, I have to ask them where they got their source. If you take a look at source number 6, I thought you were going to say James Michener. The source. So source number 6 tells us why it matters. Why does the Torah need to include this detail about where the entrance is? Ufesacha teva b'tzidat tasim, you shall place the entrance of the boat in its side. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Limdascha Torah derech eretz. The Torah taught you derech eretz. Now remember, we already saw this idea a few weeks ago. Derech eretz does not mean respect. Derech eretz means the way of the world, the way, proper conduct. Right? When we translate derech eretz to mean respect, that's a function of the literal meaning of it, which is the way things are supposed to be. So that's the idea, that respect is the way things are supposed to be. Working on it. But the Rabbi Yitzchak says, Limdascha Torah derech eretz, the Torah taught you the way of the world, meaning this is practical design guidance. And how does it work? Shem osa adam traklin eser al eser. If a person makes a room of 10 by 10, and traklin is usually, it's a Greek word, it's not one of ours, but it's used to refer not just to a room, but to a nice room. Like a palace has a traklin. Sorry?
Ulam.
Ulam, yeah, like a hall. Right, it's something, it's a nice space. So if you make a nice space that is 10 by 10, meaning, we assume, 10 amma by 10 amma, yehei osef pischo min hatzad, you should make the entrance on its side. What in the world are you talking about? Why is this the way? I mean, it's nice, because a few weeks ago we learned about boat construction. Now we're learning about interior design. But why is this good advice for interior? Do we have any interior designers here? The comment on this?
It's feng shui.
Well, we're all interior designers now. Right. Feng shui. What is this about? So in order to answer this question, we first need to ask ourselves a different question. When it says, if you make a room that's 10 by 10, put the entrance in its side, does that mean exclusively a room that's 10 by 10? If a room is 9 by 9, then we don't need to worry about this? Is this only within the view that the rooms were 10 by 10? Of course not. The boat isn't 10 by 10, it's the entrance to the boat. So what do you mean? What is the guidance that's being given here? Is this rooms that are up to 10 by 10?
But any
rooms that are 10 by 10 or more?
Any side can be a side.
Well, no. I think that's a very important point. And actually, this goes back to the question, Sharon. Maybe this actually will help us figure out where the entrance is. When it says side here, the way that the commentators universally take it is that it means the edge. Meaning, if you imagine this room to be the teva, to be the boat, then your entrance, if it's on that wall, is going to be either that corner or that corner. It means make it a corner entrance. That's good. I hadn't thought about it before, but of course that's the way they're taking it. Is that it's a corner entrance.
Why of course?
It's because it's going to fit the commentators that we're going to see. All of them are going to understand it that way. I just hadn't thought about it. Yeah?
So, why didn't it just, instead of saying side, why didn't it say corner?
Yeah, what if? Would have taken away the fun. What would I have done for the next 10 minutes? The answer is, because I think the word sad is actually the best word for corner that you're going to see in Biblical Hebrew. Meaning, we have other words that we use in Hebrew later. Keren Zavit is sort of the standard phrase. Pina is also used, but not in a biblical. I'm trying to think of a term, of a place where you use the word pina to mean corner in Biblical Hebrew. It's not a corner there. We use it to mean that. Yeah. Yeah, but there's no. That's not from the Book of Esther. That's colonial America.
Right. So is there nothing but the
Well, when the Mishkan is described, when they, right, the tabernacle that they, you're right, Karnot HaMizbeach, but I'm not sure that that means corner. I think it actually is a reference to horn, because of the way they jut out. But the when the Mishkan is described, this tabernacle that the Jews are going to use in the wilderness, which is also a rectangle, we get the description of the dimensions and how many boards you have per side, and it uses the word tzad, Sela as well as tzad, to describe the sides, and the corners in particular, I think, are tzad. So that would strengthen the idea that tzad actually means not the side of it, but the edge or the corner of it. In terms of what this means, and trying to understand this, the commentators that I see present three possible explanations. I'm going to suggest two, because the third one I think really is illogical. I'll mention it, but there are two possible explanations. The third I'm going to reject. That's the one that's written as or in source number 7. The first one comes from Yafei Tawar. Yafei Tawar says 10 by 10 is the minimum space. If your room is going to be 10 by 10 or more, put the entrance on the side. Why? So Yafei Tawar says because the room looks nice if the walls have a nice stretch without interruption. If your room is small, then it doesn't make a difference where you put it, because the wall's going to be broken up regardless. But if you have a big room, take advantage of it. Give yourself some nice space and put the entrance in the corner. That's the Yafei Tawar. He's a total interior design. Nothing to do with utility. No, you know, this is the way you should make your rooms look. Rashi, for his part, also says it means a room that's a minimum of 10 by 10. And he says it's because the entrance tends to take up space within the house. When you walk into the room, you put stuff down, that kind of thing. So he says in a small room, it doesn't matter. Because wherever you put your entrance, realistically, you know, it's going to take up space within the body of the room. But if you have a large room, then maximize your space from a utilitarian perspective by putting the entrance in the corner. Then people will come into the room and they'll put their stuff down, and you still have a broad space to work with within the room. It's an even more utilitarian element of guidance that we are receiving. Both of those are clearly assuming, and this was my point, Sharon, that they're assuming that it's in the corner. The third take there was actually one that I had thought of myself. But then I saw it in a latter day comment to the Medrash, but it's wrong. And that was the suggestion that we're talking about rooms that are small. If the room is up to 10 by 10, put your entrance in the corner. And the reason would be because you have very little space within the room, so therefore make sure that the entrance isn't going to take up too much space. You don't want it to dominate everything else if there really isn't that much space in the room. The reason I say it's not logical is because, as I noted before, this is the entrance for the boat as a whole. Right? It's not an entrance to a small, you know, space of less than 10 by 10. So it doesn't make any sense. So scratch out the third one. It's wrong. The proper explanation is that 10 by 10 is the minimum space of the that we're talking about, and either we're giving advice for the way it'll look nice, that's the way that the Yafei Tawar takes it, and we're saying that your walls will look nicer if they're not broken up by an entrance, or the approach of Rashi, a utilitarian approach, that in a large room you want to maximize the room's space and keep your entrance on the edge. That's the idea. This is still very strange. I mean, I understand that you're giving me guidance and you're saying that you're supposed to plan your rooms, and here is the way that you plan your rooms. So God says to Noah, listen, put the entrance on the corner. But is there no anchor in the biblical text? There is an anchor in the biblical text. And the answer to that comes from the Malbim. The Malbim, living in the 19th century, I think he's Czech, if I remember correctly, from Czechoslovakia at the time. He gave a very interesting explanation for this. In general, you have to know, when you're working with the commentary of the Malbim, I think it's Rabbi Yehuda Leibush is his name, if I remember correctly. But you have to know when you're dealing with him, one of his main goals in his commentary to Tanakh is to show that every single word has significance. It's called omnisignificance. And everything that you think is a synonym of something else is not. each word has a unique nuance to it. One of his goals is to counter the biblical critics of his day who say that this is a human document and you shouldn't get all hung up in why this word is used here and that word is used there. It was edited and put together. And he says, no, 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 there's design here. And every single word has special meaning. And that's where this comes into play. He makes a comment about the difference between the word latet and the word lasim. Or as I put it here, broadening the verbs, sima and nitina. Both of these are words that are used to mean to place something somewhere. But he says they mean two different things. Take a look at source number 8, please. He says, Yesh hevdel bein sima ubein nitina. There is a difference between sima and nitina, even though both mean to put something somewhere. Bepoal nitina, in the verb nitina, latet, yashkif al hahanacha atzma. So one pays attention to the actual placement. Meaning, you want to put something somewhere, and you're making sure that you follow through to put the item down. Whereas, bepoal sima, in the verb sima, yashkif al echut hahanacha. One pays attention to the quality of the placement, by which we mean you figure out where to put it and how to put it. The word lasim connotes a more careful planning of the act. There's intent involved in figuring out where you're going to put this and how you're going to get it there. Or not how you're going to get it there, but where you're going to put it. For example, Moshe is told right after the Aseret HaDibrot, right after the Ten Commandments, he is told, Ve'ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. These are the laws that you shall place before them. And the Medrash comments, that's a very odd turn of phrase. It should say, these are the laws you will teach them. Right? Or these are the laws you shall tell them. What do you mean that you shall place before them? And the Medrash comments, you shall place before them kishulchan aruch, like a set table. From which we get the phrase for Shulchan Aruch that becomes used for the code of Jewish law. But you shall place it before them like a set table, meaning arrange everything. Think carefully about how you're going to teach them. Teach it this way, teach it that way, in this order, whatever. But there has to be thought that's going to go into your teaching, Moshe. You can't just lay out the laws before them the way I'm telling them to you. It's not going to work. So there again, the operative verb is tasim. You shall place them with thought. And so too here, flip back to source number 1, the word in the text is, Ufesa hateva bitzida tasim. You shall place the entrance to the boat in its side, tasim, with planning, with forethought. Figure out where to put it. And that's what leads our medrash here in source number 6 to say, there's a reason why it should be placed in the tzad. There's a reason why it should be placed in the on the edge of the boat. And really, edge, I think, is going to be my go-forward translation instead of sign, because edge carries it much better. But the point is that you shall place the entrance in the edge of the boat, either because it'll make it look nicer, as odd as that is when you're talking about cramming everybody into these little 6x6 rooms. Nonetheless, you should place the entrance in the side so that it won't ruin the lines of the room. Or alternatively, from a utilitarian perspective, when it comes to loading and unloading, it makes more sense for you not to take up the main space of the room and have everything dumped right by the entrance in the middle, but instead, this way, everything will be put down by the wall, and then you'll be able to use effectively the space in the room for distribution as Rashi takes it. So that would be the idea. But what we've seen today are two midrashim, which really are just text. They're not teaching us moral, ethical lessons. They're teaching us basic lessons about how I am supposed to understand two phrases. One, the boat terminating in an amma at the top. And two, the entrance being in the edge of the boat. But along the way, we pick up some very interesting ideas, including the idea of filling out the story. When the story is missing pieces, the sages are asking, so how many rooms are there, and what's the layout, and what size are the rooms? And second, this idea of the entrance, that we're concerned not only with the ethical advice, but also with the practical advice that's going to give us insight into day-to-day life. The next medrash, God willing, is going to add one more point on the design of the boat, and that will be in terms of why there are three floors and what each of the floors is for. After that, I will devote some time, I think, to doing a summary of this sequence of midrashim that we've had that talked about the construction. And then we'll move on to, God willing, the fourth sequence of midrashim on the parasha. Please do email me your thoughts about continuing next year with medrash or tackling some other text. I'm open.
So we know that there's only one entrance and we know all the animals survive?
That's a really good question. Number one?
I don't know.
No. Number one, the Torah only mentions one entrance, so that's all I have to work with. We don't know of another entrance. I would have liked to have thought there was an emergency entrance in case of fire, but yeah, I don't know. That's one. In terms of the animals surviving, the answer is the Midrashim will suggest that not all the animals survive. I don't know if we're going to get there, but there are Midrashim that address that question. The biblical text does not say. Okay.